in our last conversation, we talked about Mark Hoffman. He started his forgery career as just a teenager when he forged some coins. How was he able to fool so many people for so long? Was he a charismatic person? We'll answer that question in just a minute. Hey, I also wanted to point out that our newest transcript is available with Dr. Ugo Perrego. It talks about the Mountain Meadows Massacre, paternity tests for Joseph's possible children other than Emma, as well as biblical literalism and the Book of Mormon and DNA. So please check it out. Check out this conversation. So tell us a little bit more about Mark. You know, what was his personality like?
Nowadays you would kind of see him as a computer nerd. He was not charismatic in the least, and he kind of had poor social skills. I remember on at least one occasion going with Lynn, some friends of Lynn, my wife and I, and we're going to have a kind of barbecue dinner at the Hoffman's house, you know, a lot of chatting and so forth. We got there a little bit late. We go in the house, and Mark has already made his dinner and eaten it. You would have thought a normal person would have waited. He didn't know and didn't care. Wow. Like I say, he didn't have a lot of, you know, he was not a good host or, those sorts of things. But he was a very personable person. And I don't remember a time ever seeing him. He never suffered from depression or those sort of things. He was not a down kind of a person. And of course, at that time, if you had any interest in Mormon history or collecting, he was the person to know, because he was always in the middle of this thing and that thing and buying and selling. And of course, by the bombing times, he had shifted most of his focus over to Americana, so he was doing relatively little with LDS church stuff, and most of it was over, American sort of things. He had a very nice wife, very pleasant person, and I think at that time they had four children. They lived up on the east side of Salt Lake, and what turns out it was the home that he had grown up in. He had purchased that, or was supposed to be purchasing that from his parents. And so it was a very regular street, Marie Avenue, and just what you'd expect in Salt Lake City on the east side, and a regular church attender. Gave no indications of really what was going on inside of him at all. He was a master deceiver. He could, and I don't know, maybe he did suffer from depression, but he never showed that. Never at all.
So we talked a little bit about, some people like to think he's a sociopath or a psychopath. It seems like you said that he's been interviewed by psychologists and they said, no, that's not true. How do they come to that conclusion? And, how would you describe somebody who kills a couple of people?
He had several psychological exams at Utah State Prison, one of which was done, I don't know if it was just part of the normal process. I would believe that the prison probably tests all the inmates for IQ, because that, of course, would affect how, they're housed and their behavior and stuff like that. But in the particular instance that I'm familiar with, the psychologist wrote up a report and he was sending it to Mensa, American Mensa, which is the Society for Geniuses, I guess. And he rated him 137 on a particular scale, and he scored the same number on another scale, which he said was above the top 2% in the nation. He was also interviewed by one of the psychologists that did the polygraph examinations. And the psychologist, he was trying to understand how he beat the polygraph. And he said in there that other than his aberrant behavior as far as the forgeries and the deceptions and the murders, he didn't present with what you would consider normal psychological problems. He described him as having a narcissistic personality disorder, but he did not present as a psychopath or a sociopath or schizophrenic or, you know, bipolar, any of that sort of thing. And he carried on, and that's one of the things that the psychiatrists talked about. He carried on a very normal life otherwise. He was he was very kind and loving to his wife and children, and that's not to say he's a great person. I mean, he murdered two people, but there was just no indications of that other than he loved to deceive people, and he started that as a young person. He started out his very first, what he feels like his deceptions, were doing card tricks and things. He loved to be able to trick people and kind of pull the wool over their eyes. And so that, I think, is where that forgery stuff card came from. But then it morphed gradually as a teenager and then eventually in his early 20s, I mean, after his mission, that's the way he made a living. Mm-hmm. And that's just an interesting little aside. The prosecutors, they interviewed him after his plea agreement and didn't record it, but took notes of it. And that was one of their first questions is, how did you do all of this stuff? And he said, well, it's really not that hard to figure. I'm again paraphrasing, but he said, it's really not that hard to figure out. He says, what do you do for a living? And he said, well, we're attorneys. And he said, are you any good at it? Well, yeah, we think so. He said, I cheat people. I deceive for a living. I'm good at it. I'm a good forger. And he did put tons of effort into learning that process and understanding that process and refining that process to a level that to this day is quite striking. He actually printed two copies of the Oath of a Free Man. One was at Schiller Wapner, and that's what was going to be sold to the Library of Congress, and then he had kept another one. That copy that Schiller Wapner had, I believe they still have it to this day. I'm not sure of that. Someone asked them if they could do some forensic testing on it, probably 4 years after the bombings. So at that point, everybody knew this thing is a forgery. There's no question. They took it to the University of California, Davis, and performed some tests on it, and I think they were essentially radiocarbon dating, and that thing came out as a legitimate document.
Yeah. Well, I know that he used to steal paper out of old library books and things like that. So I'm not
smart
too surprised.
Or lucky. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to figure out. For example, the Salamander letter, that paper came from the University of Utah in a book called the Niles Register. And in those days, they didn't have nearly as much under lock and key. And so those Niles Registers were just sitting out on the stacks. Well, those kind of books, they always have some fly leaves, some empty pages. And so what he did is he went in there with a briefcase, and then he had devised a simple little thing. He'd taken a razor blade and put some tape around it. So there was just a teeny little edge sticking out. And so then he would just take that book to the study carrel where nobody could see him, and he would just very carefully slice out two or three pages and not bend them, slide them into that briefcase, put the book back. And I don't believe, had this not ever happened, to this day I don't know that anybody would have ever found that. Because who would take those old Niles Registers and leaf through them to make sure all the fly leaves in there? Nobody would. But he picked those because he knew it was the same kind of paper, so he did do substantial historical research to find the same kind of paper. So when that Salamander letter was tested, the paper is real. It is not fake. That is real 1830 paper. Oath of a Free Man, the same thing. Except there, he got it out of a Bible down at BYU.
Oh, no way.
It was still out in the stacks. Now that one, again, the research is significant. And maybe I should just stop here for just a second, because I'm describing a lot of things and they're very amazing and it's all very interesting. But I don't want to come off ever as not knowing what happened. He is first and foremost a murderer. And that's who he is. And he should spend the rest of his natural life in prison for it. He murdered two innocent people that had nothing to do with him and did nothing to him. This cannot be claimed as an act of passion or rage or nothing. They did nothing to him. And he murdered those two people, and that really, I mean, everyone needs to keep firmly in mind that's, we're talking about a murderer. Yeah. But at any rate, the paper for that oath of a free man, there was not paper-making facilities in what became the United States and Massachusetts in those days, so it had to be brought over from England. Well, the paper in those days when it was made, it's made out in sheets and then it's dried. There's these big sheets and then they put it out on a screen mesh. And as that wet paper sits on there, it makes a little impression. And under magnification, you can see that impression. They call that chain marks, either grid marks or chain mark. Chain marking is the usual way to do that. Well, Bayson book, he found a real one. He was able to examine one back east somewhere at a library. And I don't know if anybody noticed, they probably didn't at the time, that he had a magnifying loop. And so he put that up real close so that he could see what the chain marking was. And of course, there weren't tons of paper manufacturers in those days. So he only maybe had a choice of 10 different papers. Well, he dug around for a long time and found a Bible that was printed in Britain, Great Britain and England, with that same paper. And you could tell by the chain marking. So as examiners looked at it, that's one of the reasons he got away with it and no one would believe because they were forgeries, is because a significant number of his most important items had been examined by competent, at least we believe at the time, competent examiners. And so, you know, at the time, somebody said, well, this is a forgery. Well, no, it's not. Because we've had it examined, and they really had. Library of Congress was not going to buy that thing unless they knew that that thing was real. But again, just took the little razor blade, pinched the piece of paper, off it went. And he didn't need to have very many because that was kind of a big sheet, and so he would cut it down and able to, you know, make more than one copy. But the way that he was able to, that thing still beat the test was, is the paper is real and legitimate. The ink was made to formula, but that ink was not old. Well, how could you test the ink? You could do it by a radiocarbon dating. Well, he somehow in his brain figured out to take some of the extra pieces of paper, legitimate paper, burn them, and then mix that carbonized paper in the ink.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yes. So they would find traces of carbon from, it turns out, from the paper that was from 16.
Wow, that's amazing. Because I've always wondered. Now, it seems like I was reading the book Salamander, and he also had some sort of a technique that aged the ink that also caused it to crack. Was that test done on this oath of a free man?
I don't know that it was. Because in this particular case, it wouldn't need to have been oxidized. Because the ink, it was of a formula that would not necessarily have turned brown because writing ink was different than printing ink.
Oh.
And he, again, had done substantial amounts of research on ink formulas. I mean, because people would make ink themselves. So it was possible to buy an almanac or something that would tell you how to make your own ink.
Okay, so this cracking problem was only a problem with written ink. It wasn't a problem with printer ink.
At least with the oath of a free man. That may have been the case on some other documents, I don't know, but the particular one, because the salamander letter is an example, that was written ink. Well, he had found the old formula. And, of course, they use funny words. They use like words like gum Arabic. But you can figure out now what the modern-day equivalent of gum Arabic is or whatever. But so with the salamander, we'll go back to that one. The paper is old and legitimate. The ink is the correct formulation. The question is, how long has that ink been on that paper? Has it been there for 6 months, or has it been there for 150 years? Well, the ink that was used very commonly in those days was called iron gallatonic. And that means there was actually an iron compound in there. Well, iron, as it gets old, rusts. So it turns from black to brown. Well, it's the oxygen interacting with the iron atoms that creates iron oxide, which is FeO3, which is rust. So essentially, you've got to get that ink to rust. So you've got to accelerate that oxidation process. Well, again, he had figured out a way to do that. One of the things he did is to make it look kind of a little older, he would put it in the oven and kind of cook it, 200 degrees, and just let it kind of cook. But the other thing that he would do is he took an old fish tank and got an old electric train motor, one of those dial things, you know, you make the electric train go. Well, if you remember, if you're old enough, you know, when you turn that on, there's a sparking, and there's a little smell that comes off there. It's O3, ozone. It's extremely strong oxidizer. So what he would do is take that finished document, put it in there, turn on the thing, put a lid on it, and let it sit for half an hour or so. That O3 would now create the same 150 years of oxidation in 30 minutes.
Holy cow.
But what happened was, is that ink, instead of being able to dry slowly, dried fast, and it cracked. Now, when that was discovered, that was not known. Whoever said that, there was a little bit of trouble at first, because other document examiners said, no, this is not a legitimate test. This doesn't mean anything. And so the people that came up with that not only had to figure that out, but had to convince the community that this is in fact a legitimate test, because no one had done that before. No one had looked for that and noticed that cracking. Or if they had, they didn't ascribe it to anything. Had they not wanted to know that Mark was guilty so badly, they wouldn't have taken the time to track that down. So in fact, it's just as we sit here and think about it, that technique may have been used for the last 100 years. By somebody else, but no one really ever keyed on it, because never has the scrutiny been so big and so intense on one person and one set of documents. Now, from now to the future, that's a regular and legitimate test, but that had to be invented.
Because of Mark. Wow, that's crazy. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Shannon Flynn. In our next conversation, we'll talk about his most audacious forgery, Oath of a Freeman. We'll also talk about Shannon Flynn's hobnobbing with some very rich people at an auction.
So I went to an auction at Sotheby's one time and saw the Emancipation Proclamation, one of the copies, the 13th Amendment, being sold. And if I recall correctly, I know one of the people, I'm sure of, was the bidder. It went way past reserves, and it came down to two bidders. One of them, I believe, and I'm going to say this, I believe, because I just can't be 100% sure. The other bidder I know for sure was Malcolm Forbes, and he was the one that eventually got it. He was bidding against, I believe, Ross Perot.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. They were making $50,000 jumps at each bid.
Click here to subscribe, click here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some other videos that we've done here on YouTube. We hope you'll use this as a valuable resource to learn more about Mormon history.